Imagine, you've just survived this horrific car crash.
Right.
You're bruised, your vehicle is completely totaled, but like miraculously, you are alive.
Thank goodness.
Exactly. And the other driver walks over looking shaken, and your very first instinct is to do what most of us would do. You say, "I am so sorry I didn't even see you."
Oh, yeah. Because you're just trying to be a decent human being in a terrifying moment.
Right. But what you don't realize is that polite, 2-second apology, it might have just cost you $1 million in necessary medical care.
It's a terrifying reality. That basic human empathy is it's instantly weaponized the second it enters the ecosystem of an insurance claim.
And that ecosystem is exactly what we're plunging into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
We are unpacking a very sobering, but I mean, a frankly crucial legal advisory published by the law offices of Norman Gershon.
Yeah, it's a really important document.
It really is. And just to set the table, we're looking at this advisory to understand a hidden world most people are entirely unprepared for. This document focuses on the catastrophic aftermath of serious New York car accidents.
Specifically head-on collisions,
Yeah,
right?
specifically head-on crashes.
Yeah.
And the whole advisory is anchored in this heartbreaking real-world tragedy on the Bethpage State Parkway.
Just awful.
It is. A 23-year-old named Jordan Nasir St. Fort Collin lost his life.
23 years old. I mean, it is an absolute tragedy.
Yeah.
And the advisory uses that specific loss to highlight a systemic danger that exists everywhere in this region.
Right. It's not just the Bethpage Parkway.
Exactly. If you do any driving through, Westchester County, White Plains, Yonkers, the Bronx, Manhattan, Queens,
Basically, anywhere in the broader New York metro area.
right, anywhere around here, you are navigating the exact conditions that make these specific crashes so devastating.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the source explicitly points out roadways like I-287, the Hutchinson River Parkway,
Yeah.
and the Sawmill River Parkway.
Oh, the sawmill.
Yeah. If you have ever driven the Sawmill, you know exactly the vibe we're talking about here.
It's terrifying.
It really is. You have these winding, incredibly narrow lanes, those low stone bridges, and like often zero shoulder.
No room for error at all.
None. And you combine that with heavy commuter traffic, drivers who are exhausted, distracted, maybe impaired, and you have this powder keg just waiting for an unsafe passing maneuver.
But what the advisory hones in on is the unique, frankly, terrifying physics of the head-on collision.
Right.
Because when someone drifts over that double yellow line, the math of the universe basically turns against you in a way that is hard to comprehend.
Wait, I want to actually dig into that math for a second.
Go for it.
Because I think there is a huge misconception here.
Yeah.
I look at modern car commercials, right?
Yeah.
And they're constantly bragging about 5-star crash ratings and crumple zones and, 15 different airbags.
Right, they make you feel invincible.
Exactly. It feels like modern cars are essentially driving tanks. So why does a head-on collision just completely bypass all of that advanced engineering?
Well, it comes down to kinetic energy and closing speed.
Okay.
When those crash tests are performed for those 5-star ratings, they're usually driving a car into a stationary barrier at maybe 35 or 40 miles per hour.
Right.
And the crumple zones are engineered to absorb that specific amount of energy. But in a head-on collision, you're dealing with relative velocity.
Oh, okay. I see where you're going.
Yeah, so if you are doing 60 miles per hour on the Hutchinson River Parkway and the vehicle drifting into your lane is also doing 60, you aren't experiencing a 60 mile an hour impact.
Right, the closing speed is 120 miles per hour.
You're taking the force of both vehicles and compounding it.
Wow.
But it is even worse than just adding the speeds together.
Wait, really? How could it be worse?
Because the kinetic energy involved squares with velocity, the sheer volume of energy generated in a fraction of a second completely overwhelms the structural integrity of the car.
So the car just can't handle it.
It can't. The crumple zones crush instantly, the engine block gets pushed into the cabin, and the airbags simply cannot deploy fast enough or with enough volume to cushion the immense deceleration your body experiences.
That is horrifying.
You are essentially taking two opposing forces and multiplying the damage beyond what any passenger vehicle is designed to withstand.
Which, I mean, that perfectly explains the brutal anatomy of the injuries listed in this advisory.
Absolutely.
Because the car's structure fails to absorb that energy, your body has to absorb it.
Exactly.
The source details injuries that are just life-altering. Traumatic brain injuries, spinal cord injuries, multiple fractures, massive internal organ damage, and, permanent disability.
Yeah, it's devastating.
And I want to linger on traumatic brain injuries for a second, because the mechanism behind how they happen in these specific crashes is, well, it's chilling.
What's fascinating here is how it's entirely tied to that rapid deceleration we were just talking about.
Right.
Your car might stop in a tenth of a second, but Newton's first law of motion dictates that your brain, which is, you know, floating in cerebrospinal fluid inside your skull.
It keeps moving.
Yes, it keeps moving forward at 60 miles per hour.
Until it hits the inside of your own forehead.
Exactly. And then it rebounds and hits the back of your skull.
Oh, wow.
That violently rapid back and forth motion causes what is known as shear force. It literally stretches and tears the microscopic nerve fibers throughout your brain.
So it's not just a concussion.
No, this isn't just a bump on the head. This is diffuse axonal injury.
Hmm?
It fundamentally rewires your cognitive function, your emotional regulation, your memory.
So if I am understanding this progression, the physical impact might be over in a second, but the systemic life disruption is like only just beginning.
That is exactly it.
Because an injury like that isn't something you just throw a cast on and wait 6 weeks for it to heal.
Not at all. And this is a core theme in the source material. A head-on collision isn't just a medical event. It is an immediate and prolonged financial crisis.
Right.
Survivors of these crashes are looking at months, sometimes years, of intensive daily rehabilitation. They require specialized neurology care, physical therapy, potentially lifelong accommodations.
And while all of those astronomical medical bills are piling up, you are simultaneously unable to work.
Exactly.
Your income effectively drops to zero at the exact moment your expenses skyrocket. I mean, it alters the entire trajectory of a family's financial stability.
Which is why the actions you take in the immediate aftermath of a crash are so absolutely critical.
The survival guide.
Yes. The advisory shifts here from diagnosing the reality of the danger to providing a very specific tactical post-crash playbook, because the stakes are simply too high to wing it.
So let's look at the mechanics of this playbook. The first step is obvious, right? Call 911 immediately. But the second directive from the source really caught my eye. It insists that you must seek medical treatment at the scene, even if your injuries feel minor.
Yes, that is crucial.
Now, knowing what we just discussed about how violent these crashes are, why would anyone feel like their injuries were minor?
It is a massive evolutionary blind spot. Adrenaline.
Oh, of course.
When you are involved in a traumatic event, your endocrine system floods your body with adrenaline and endorphins.
To mask the pain.
Exactly. From an evolutionary perspective, this is designed to mask extreme pain so you can physically run away from a predator. It's a pure survival mechanism.
So your body is essentially lying to you.
Completely lying to you. You might be sitting on the side of the road with torn ligaments, internal bleeding in your abdomen, or the beginning stages of a severe concussion, and you honestly feel fine.
You just feel a little jittery, maybe.
Right. You might just feel a little stiff or on edge.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The danger isn't just medical, right? There's a strategic danger here.
Oh, massive strategic danger.
If I tell the paramedics, no thanks, I'm okay, I don't need an ambulance, what does that actually do to my claim down the line?
It gives the insurance company a massive loophole.
How so?
Well, if you decline medical attention at the scene and then wake up 2 days later in agonizing pain and go to the emergency room, the insurance adjuster will point to that gap.
Oh, I see.
They will argue that if you were really injured in the crash, you would have taken the ambulance. They'll try to claim that you must have injured yourself doing something else in those 48 hours.
That is incredibly cynical.
It is. But that cynicism is the foundation of the industry. Therefore, they argue they are not liable.
Wow. Okay, so the playbook continues by instructing victims to document the scene meticulously, assuming it is physically safe to do so.
Yes. Take wide photos of the cars, close-ups of the damage.
Pictures of the roadway, skid marks, weather conditions.
Get witness names and phone numbers immediately before they drive away.
And critically, preserve every single medical record and repair estimate from minute one.
You are basically establishing a chain of custody for your own life.
Right. Because to your point, skid marks get washed away by the rain.
Cars get crushed at the scrapyard.
Exactly. And witnesses' memories fade. If you don't secure that evidence right then, it ceases to exist.
And that leads directly to the most critical warning in the entire advisory.
Which is?
The source emphatically states that you must avoid discussing fault with insurance companies before speaking to an attorney.
Okay, I want to push on this really hard.
Go ahead.
Because let's say I am sitting at home the day after a crash.
Okay.
The phone rings, And it is the other driver's insurance adjuster.
Right.
They sound friendly, they ask how I'm feeling, and they just want to, you know, get my side of the story so they can process my claim faster.
Yeah, standard script.
Why shouldn't I just explain what happened? Aren't insurance companies legally obligated to operate in good faith and process valid claims?
They are obligated to operate in good faith, yes, but good faith does not mean maximizing your payout. You have to think of an insurance adjuster less like a customer service rep and more like a casino pit boss.
A pit boss.
Yes. Their entire job is to calculate risk and stop the bleeding to the house's bottom line. The source is very clear on this point. Insurance companies begin investigating immediately, and their structural goal is to minimize payouts.
So they aren't on my side.
Not even a little bit. They are highly trained interrogators gathering data for risk mitigation
When
algorithms.
I offer that polite apology we talked about at the very beginning of the deep
All
dive.
right, I'm sorry.
Yeah, saying, I'm sorry, things happen so fast. Am I essentially showing the pit boss my cards?
Precisely. Because in New York, the legal concept of comparative negligence is at play.
What does that mean exactly?
It means if the insurance company can find a way to assign even 10 or 20% of the blame to you, they can reduce your payout by that exact percentage. So if you are on a recorded line, right, and you casually mention, I was just checking my rearview mirror for a second when they swerved, you have just handed them evidence of inattention.
That's insane.
They will weaponize your own politeness, your brain fog, and your trauma against you to save their company money.
That asymmetry of power is just staggering. You have an individual who is in pain, likely on medication, terrified about their job,
Yep.
going up against a multi-billion dollar corporate entity that handles, what, thousands of these calls a day?
Which is exactly why the advisory pivots to the absolute necessity of leveling that playing field through high-level legal representation.
Right.
If the insurance company is building a case against you from day one,
Yeah.
you need a professional who can disrupt their machinery.
And the text lays out exactly how a lawyer intervenes. They take over all communication so you can't accidentally fall into those recorded line traps.
Goodness.
Yeah. And they independently investigate the collision, often bringing in accident reconstruction experts.
Which is absolutely vital in head-on collisions.
Why specifically head on?
Well, determining exactly who crossed the center line on a chaotic road like the Sawmill Parkway, it requires analyzing crush damage, yaw marks on the pavement, onboard vehicle telemetry.
It's basically a science experiment.
Exactly. You need experts to prove the physics of the fault.
They also handle the incredibly complex negotiations, calculating not just what the hospital bill is today, but forecasting your lost earning potential and future medical needs over the next 30 years.
Right.
And to illustrate what this tier of legal strategy looks like, the advisory uses the law offices of Norman Gershon as the model.
Yes.
The text highlights his specific background. Over 35 years of experience representing accident victims from Westchester County all the way down through the boroughs to Brooklyn.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the most interesting detail in the source material isn't just the timeline of his career.
What is it?
It is his specific reputation within the legal ecosystem.
Okay.
The text describes Norman Gershon as the lawyer other attorneys call to try their toughest cases.
Oh, that's a serious distinction.
It really is. It notes a track record of recovering tens of millions of dollars in verdicts and settlements, and it emphasizes something crucial insurance companies know and fear Norman Gershon.
See, I have to admit, my initial thought when reading that was, okay, a lawyer is a lawyer.
Right, a lot of people think that.
Yeah, like as long as someone has passed the bar exam and filed the lawsuit, does the insurance company really care whose name is on the letterhead? Why does that specific reputation matter so much?
It matters more than almost any other factor because it fundamentally alters the insurance company's risk algorithm.
Really?
Yes, insurance carriers use highly sophisticated software to evaluate claims, and they actively track the data on opposing counsel. They literally categorize plaintiffs' attorneys.
They have a tier system for lawyers.
Absolutely, they do. They know exactly which attorneys are what the industry calls settlement mills.
What's a settlement mill?
These are high-volume law firms that want to process cases quickly. They will take the first or second low-ball offer because they do not want to spend the money, the time, or the intense effort required to actually prepare a case for a jury trial.
So if the insurance company's software flags your lawyer as a settlement mill, they know they can just wait you out. They call your bluff.
Yes. They have absolutely no incentive to offer you top dollar because they know your lawyer is terrified of the courtroom.
Wow.
But when you introduce an attorney like Norman Gershon, someone with a 35-year track record of trying difficult cases, someone who has actively pulled tens of millions of dollars out of insurance companies via jury verdicts, the math changes instantly.
It's like playing poker with someone who, has an infinite bankroll and isn't afraid to go all in.
That is the perfect way to look at it. The insurance company knows that a trial is incredibly expensive for them to defend, and juries are unpredictable.
Right. A jury might award a victim far more than the insurance company ever wanted to settle for.
Exactly. So the mere credible threat of a trial acts as leverage. It forces the adjuster to evaluate the claim seriously from the very beginning. The willingness to go to court is, paradoxically, the exact thing that produces fair settlements outside of court.
That makes total sense. And it brings up a really practical point mentioned in the text that we should clarify. For anyone listening who is thinking, I could never afford a lawyer who has that kind of reputation, the advisory notes that firms operating at this level, including Gershon's, work on a contingency fee basis, meaning clients only pay if they win the case. The source even provides their direct line. Let me read it here, 914, 485, 1444, emphasizing that victims can get this machinery working for them without paying retainers up front.
Which is crucial because, as we established earlier, the victim's income has likely just plummeted.
Right.
The contingency model aligns the lawyer's financial incentive directly with the victim's recovery. Only pay if you win.
So we have covered a tremendous amount of ground today. Let's trace the arc of this deep dive.
Let's do it.
We started with the tragic reality of these high-speed parkway crashes in the New York metro area, recognizing that the very design of these historic roads creates a unique hazard. We broke down the terrifying physics of head-on collisions, explaining how that compounded kinetic energy bypasses modern safety features.
And inflicts life-altering systemic trauma like those diffuse axonal injuries we talked about.
Exactly. We then explored the psychological and strategic traps of the immediate aftermath, how adrenaline lies to your body, and how insurance adjusters use your politeness and confusion to mitigate their corporate liability.
The post-crash playbook is strict for a very good reason. Secure medical help, document the scene, and whatever you do not chat away your rights on a recorded line.
And finally, we unpacked the hidden mechanics of legal leverage. We looked at why an insurance company's algorithm evaluates a claim completely differently when the victim is represented by a known trial lawyer.
Someone with a reputation for taking difficult cases to court rather than just seeking a quick settlement.
It is about understanding the unseen architecture of the system you are forced to navigate when the unthinkable happens.
It really is.
So, what does this all mean for you? Look, nobody gets in their car on a Tuesday morning anticipating a life-altering event.
No, of course not.
We all hope that this information remains purely theoretical for you. But knowing the mechanics of these dangers, understanding the traps to avoid, and recognizing the strategic value of high-level representation, that is a vital part of being a prepared, well-informed driver.
It's the armor you hope you never have to wear.
Perfectly said.
And, reviewing this material leaves me with a very persistent, provocative thought about the environment we drive in every day.
What's that?
Well, we spend billions of dollars engineering sensors, automatic braking systems, and stronger steel for our cars.
Right.
But as we see with crashes on roads like the Sawmill or the Hutchinson River Parkway, that technology is instantly neutralized by the environment.
Wow.
It raises an uncomfortable question. Are we fighting a losing battle by trying to out-engineer human error inside the car while completely ignoring the antiquated, undivided 1920s design of the parkways those cars are actually driving on?
That is a fascinating point. We put space-age technology onto horse and buggy infrastructure, and we act surprised when the physics don't work out.
Exactly.
It is definitely something to chew on the next time you find yourself navigating those narrow, winding lanes inches away from oncoming traffic. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it gave you some clarity and a stronger understanding of the hidden forces on the road. Stay safe out there, stay informed, and we will catch you on the next one.